Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and all over the world. The election's over, so I bet you're glad of that. This week we're going to feature festivals instead, and in particular the North Devon Walking Festival. So, with that in mind, hello to Martin, Jasmine and Hanny at Dolly's Cafe in Ilfracombe, where you can sample one of the best crab salads in the southwest. Our studio guests this week are Jude English, who's here to talk about social entrepreneurship, and we're going to speak to Hazel Hammond, who's going to talk about her poetry and the art of tattoos. Our features this week are by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling as ever, and Malcolm Greaves reads another chapter of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Trevor Carter, our resident bard, is here later on to read his latest poem, and Jess Barks is back in the studio for his What Song Guide and the Song of the Week. Well, I'm John Peters Coleman, and I'd like to welcome our first studio guest, Jude English. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about your background and why you're sort of interested in social entrepreneurship.
Well, I'm trying to change the world myself, and that's what social entrepreneurs try and do. Mm-hmm. I've done various forays into the world of education and ended up with the Open University, and I'm doing a PhD researching why people start to become social entrepreneurs and how they can be supported while they're doing their kind of write on social businesses and ethical trading and all the rest.
Right, okay. So, I mean, you didn't start small, unambitious then. So what did you do to try and change the world? Well, when did this mission start?
Well, I think we all try to change the world in our own little ways, don't we? But I suppose my main thrust was through lots of youth work in my 20s and 30s, and I did a lot of work with the Woodcraft Folk, which is a kind of socialist, peace-loving branch of the Scouts and Guides, and then went on to lots of political campaigning, lesbian and gay rights, CND, stuff like that. Hmm. And all those people could be classed as social entrepreneurs in a way. They're doing kind of things that change the world.
Okay, so I mean, it sounds like quite a broad spectrum of activities is covered by social entrepreneurship. When entrepreneurship is just, you're kind of going to make out there to make some money, but also do it in a sort of slightly ethical way whilst you're about it.
Yeah, that's right. It's been around for a long, long time. Of course, there's been people for hundreds of years who've acted socially entrepreneurially. John Muir, for example, who went off to America and started the National Park Movement and things like that. But since about, I don't know, the beginning of this century maybe, it's become quite popular. The Labour government came in 97 and they were very keen on the idea of people being socially enterprising and social entrepreneurship. So the particular people I'm researching are those who've been given grants by the lottery to do little projects to start them off. It's an offshoot of the Millennium Awards. So this was a whole branch of, well, in fact, the government gave £100 million endowment to a charity called Unlimited to give pots of money to people to do worthwhile things.
Okay, so I mean, I guess it's not only environmental. I mean, I know that certainly what is quite popular is communal ownership or provision of public services, and city councils are quite sort of keen on getting involved in that. So what have you sort of researched or found out about that?
Well, yeah, that's very popular, particularly with all the main parties at the moment, isn't it? Cooperative ownership or cooperative shares or community shares.
So that's just a way of sort of forking out the responsibility to other people or something, yeah.
It could be. Yes, I think there are some issues there about how that happens. But one of the ideas that I think most people who are social entrepreneurs might agree with is that it should be the people who participate in doing something who try and get things done and to take democratic decisions about what happens. So cooperative ideas or shares of ownership is to do with having control over what happens to your building or your business or your kind of local bus service maybe.
Okay.
I mean, Bristol's got lots of co-ops. I mean, I heard you say that you were one at the beginning.
Yeah.
But the wireless cooperative, the bike cooperative, all those things would be classed as part of social entrepreneurship. And it depends which party you're from, how much you think that's a good thing.
Right, okay. Is there much of a north-south divide with this thing? I mean, are there just as many up north?
There's not so much a north-south divide as a city-rural divide, actually, in terms of research. You will find lots of people able to act more entrepreneurial in a way, perhaps in cities like Bristol or Liverpool or Manchester, where you've got a big group of people, but you've also got buildings that they can use, you've got councils that might be supportive, and you've got possibly universities where you've got lots of bright young things thinking, new ideas.
So what do you think has to happen to be able to improve the chances of their happening? Probably where people need them most, I imagine.
Well, there is some research really that shows that one of the things that people need is spaces to meet. Places like Hamilton House in Stokes Croft, you know, kind of spaces where groups can get together, can learn from each other, can support each other and share resources is obviously very helpful. And also places like The Hub down near the Arnolfini,
yep,
which is a kind of shared space. So places like that, and also money. You know, part of it is that people who haven't got access to capital, which was the original entrepreneurial, you know, thing you would need. The merchants' ventures had lots of capital, and capitalist entrepreneurs, that's what they work on. You do need a bit of money probably to get you going, which is why charities like Unlimited were set up.
Okay, so what do you think where the potential of social entrepreneurship lies now? How do you think that could be improved, and how far do you think that can go? I mean, could everything potentially be sort of communally owned in such a way? I mean, that's where I guess it starts to get maybe a bit political, possibly.
Ah, well, yes. Are we moving towards utopia? I don't know. Can you own everything communally? Possibly that's a bit of a long stretch for most people.
Yeah.
But participation in democracy and participation in choosing how things are run, I think a lot of people would be in favour of.
Right.
And having more control over what happens locally to your services or your hospital or, you know, your community garden. So it is about changes in the democratic process, I think, rather than...
There still has to be, I guess, even a cooperative, some kind of tree of authority, if you like, some kind of pyramid, somebody at the top who has the knowledge of these things. I mean, otherwise, you know, it would require an awful lot of self-motivation on behalf of everybody to try and keep it going. People may not necessarily know what to do, where to go for support and motivation.
Perhaps this is one of the big issues that maybe people don't know how to organise anymore, because there's not so much activity in trade unions and things like that.
Mm.
That may be one of the difficulties. But the government is putting lots of money into schools and helping young people become entrepreneurial. So let's hope that works out that way.
Okay. And I understand you are organising or involved in the happiness lectures, is it?
No, I'm not organising it, but part of my research is into how you can help people cope with failure when their projects go a little bit wrong and stuff.
Okay.
But in terms of that, positive psychology is very helpful to get people through the kind of difficult times. And Chris Johnson is running the happiness lectures on the 18th of May at St George's. And they're a fantastic 1 hour, really fun way to learn some positive psychology and some actual practices for keeping you happy and keeping you motivated when, you know, you need that little extra bit of oomph.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in, and it'd be nice to hear a little bit more about social entrepreneurship in sort of coming weeks and years.
Okay. No, thanks for having me.
Before I introduce our next guest, here's a West Country song called Bridgewater Fair, and it's from an album by Tom and Barbara Brown called West Country Night Out, and it was purchased at the Coombe Martin Museum, where, for all of those interested, the annual Town May Festival takes place at the end of this month, from Friday the 28th of May to Monday the 31st. It's called The Hunting of the Earl of Roane, and it's a traditional village custom there involving a hobby horse, a fool, and there'll be grenadiers, drummers, dancers, musicians, and a character called the Earl of Roane.
Both young and old, come listen to me story bold. From all around, from far and near, they come to see the rigs of the fair. Oh, Master John, do you beware? Don't you go kissing the girls at Bridgewater Fair. The jovial ploughboys all serene, they dance the maids all over the green. Says John to Mary, don't you know, you'll not go home to the morning, oh. Oh, Master John, do you beware, don't you go kissing the girls at Bridgewater Fair. There's Tom and Bob, they look so gay, with Sal and Kit, they haste away. They laugh and shout and have a spree, and dance and sing right and merrily. Oh, Master John, do you beware, don't you go kissing the girls at Bridgewater Fair. The lads and lasses, they come through, from Stowey's to Gersey and Cannington too. That farmer from Finnington, true as me life, he's come to the fair for to look for a wife. Oh, Maslejander, you beware. Don't you go kissing the girls at Bridgewater Fair. There's Carroty, it's a jolly and fat, with her good flippity-floppity heart. A hole in her stocking so big as a crown, and the hoops of her skirt hanging down to the ground. Oh, Master Jan, do you beware? Don't you go kissing the girls at Bridgewater Fair.
Oh, well, that was Bridgewater Fair, from an album by Tom and Barbara Brown called West Country Night Out. Oh, I'd like to welcome Hazel Hammond to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
You're a poet, I understand. How long have you been a poet?
Well, I've been writing since I was a young woman, but I threw most of it away. I've only started writing seriously in the last 5 years, I suppose.
Okay, and you've been interested in tattoos specifically, especially lately. Is this a new interest?
Well, yes, it is. It kind of came over me in a flood last year, and the poems started coming, and I wrote an awful lot, and I realised this was a subject worth going with.
Okay. I mean, have you noticed a particular increase in the number of tattoos over the past sort of few years or decades? I mean, was this
Certainly, tattoos have become very fashionable now. You see them on celebrities. And I think it's estimated that if you're under 30, about a third of people will have tattoos.
Okay, right. I mean, they're very sort of an interesting topic, I guess, because they're kind of permanent, or mostly permanent. These days, you can get them lasered off. I mean, do you think that possibly leads people to get stuff done? They don't really think properly about it.
I don't think people get stuff done more often than they used to. There's always been a community who thinks about it, who does it carefully, and the number of people who just do it on a whim, I think, is going down, really.
Right, okay.
There's certainly a fashion element, but I think that's going.
I think the one that springs to mind famously is Johnny Depp, who got Winona tattooed on him because he's married to Winona Ryder, and then when he got divorced, scrubbed a bit out, so it just said Wino. but I guess a lot of people aren't going to be quite so lucky. I mean, what have you found out about sort of the varieties? Because, I mean, I guess, obviously, the traditional ones would be less common, and these days would be a whole wide variety.
Yes. What I found out was there are all sorts of tattoo styles. Mm-hmm. There's traditional, and there's modern traditional, and there's Japanese, and there's tribal. There are kind of tattoos which have been imported from other cultures, so Maori tattoos, which people have as well.
Okay, so what is the origin of tattoos? I mean, I know people think sailors from abroad, but from where?
Well, there's quite a lot of dispute about the history of tattooing. There's a guy in Amsterdam who I met who's written the Encyclopedia of Tattoos.
Wow.
In Dutch. And I don't speak Dutch. And I interviewed him. And he leant forward and put his very large hand over mine and said, "My dear, there's a lot of rubbish talked about the history of tattoos," and I was writing my notes. I went back to check what he'd said, and actually he'd spun me a line, which I thought was quite amusing. So there's
an uncertainty about the history of tattoos.
Well, there is really. We seem to think that it's probably come from the South Seas with Captain Cook into the UK. Mm-hmm. So that's probably about the time period.
Okay. I mean, did you
1850s.
Chat to people about their tattoos?
I did, yes. I've interviewed about 50 people about their tattoos, and their inner stories are so interesting. That's really what stimulated the poetry more than anything.
I mean, apart from also getting your kid's name done in sort of Gothic script, I mean, what were some of the more interesting ones that you discovered about them? What their meanings were?
Well, a woman who learned circus skills here in Bristol had a unicycle tattooed on her arm so that she could always remember her time in the circus, which I thought was pretty nice, and could show it to her grandchildren. And until she said that to me, I'd never thought of that, of course. So that's fun. And people have bees and I don't know, just anything you want.
Is it a traditionally masculine activity, or do you find
not it? Nowadays. It used to be, certainly, but it isn't now, no.
Right, okay. I mean, apart from sort of symbolic things, I mean, what other reasons could are there? Have you sort of found out, either unusual or unusual, that
Well, perhaps you'd like to listen to a poem from the book.
Okay.
It's called No Tattoo, because I haven't got one, and it tells you some of the reasons people get tattooed.
Okay, brilliant. Let's hear it.
Sacred only to me, my undecorated flesh reproaches me. No marks of identity, culture, or even working life. Only bruises, broken veins, and as yet pale age spots. Still the skin upbraids me. No marks of battles fought, loves lost, or even children grown. I have apparently lived tracklessly, moving as a fish in water. No tattoos like locks or bridges in my journey, holding a ripple still. I've been getting away with the insubstantial, lack of commitment to a cause or campaign. But what would I mark my body with? In this state, I question every word, image or pattern, each too weighty. They drag away my skin into folds, tweak my conscience like an unkept resolution, only demonstrating and repeating my mistakes. So it's no tattoo. Well, as yet, anyway.
Well, thank you very much. And have you... will you, if you do decide, you know, what sort of design do you think you might like? Do you think you'd ever get one?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. When this process comes to the end, when the book is published and mm-hmm. the performances are done, then I will. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. What is the most remarkable tattoo that you've seen in your travels?
I think the most remarkable one, there's an artist called Escher whose designs are extremely complex. Mm-hmm. And to transfer a flat design, a flat complex design, onto the rounded surface of a skin so it still looks the same, I think it's an amazing thing to do. And a local tattooist did that as a competition piece. It's
good Lord.
Astonishing.
Okay, you've got a book launch coming up, so let's skip to that. So tell me a little bit about your book. It's called Needlepoint, published by City Chameleon Press.
That's right, okay. Here in Bristol, local publisher. It's the only book of poetry and tattoos. And it actually takes you through the journey of having a tattoo. So the first section is inklings about ideas mm-hmm. about tattoos, okay. through to the final inked story, so to speak.
Okay, and there's going to be a book launch on Friday, May the 28th, 7:30 in the evening at the Halo Cafe Bar, which is on Gloucester Road. I've got an email address here to find out more. Is this your...
It is, yes. And if you want to tell me your tattoo story, get in touch by email at toptatstories@hotmail.com.
Brilliant. toptatstories@hotmail.com. Well, Hazel Hammond, the very best of luck with your book, and thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page, and it's an interview with Dave Edgecombe, a guide at the North Devon Walking Festival, and it was recorded on a very windy seafront at Ilfracombe.
My name's Dave Edgecombe. I work for the Northern Devon Coast and Countryside Service as the AOMB Project Officer for North Devon.
You're doing a guided walk today?
That's right, yes. It's a guided walk around Ilfracombe and Lee today as part of the North Devon Walking Festival, which is held each year over the bank holiday, the May bank holiday weekend. And it's this year that it's our 50th anniversary celebrations as an area of outstanding natural beauty. And so our organisation is supporting this walking festival both financially and by leading walks.
Well, today I'm going on a walk with Dave. It's called Old Tracks for Coach and Train. And we're going to follow the old railway line from Ilfracombe to Morto, passing the Slade Reservoirs. And then we're going to walk the coast at Lee Village to follow the old coaching road across the Tors back to Ilfracombe.
Okay, well, this is Slade Tunnel. It's the only tunnel on the line, and it's a curved tunnel of about 69 yards in length. It gets very damp in this tunnel, and as a result, a lot of train drivers were very keen to get through this bit, because if they got stuck here, because it was very damp inside and the wheels would slip, they'd have to back all the way down to Ilfracombe to start again. And they were very keen not to sort of get stuck here, and there's sort of recorded stories of guards being left behind at Ilfracombe station because the driver was so keen to get going. and left the guard behind, who had to catch the taxi and meet the train at Mort Hoe at the top. Sort of forgetting the historical element. If you look down through there, there's just an avenue of trees now. Mm-hmm. That's what happens if you don't cut, graze or manage an area of land. Eventually it will revert to woodland. And woodland is what's known as a climax vegetation in the UK, so that if you did nothing, eventually it would all return to woodland. And this is an example. There's fences either side. It's not grazed. There's a little bit of line-side maintenance to keep the track clear. And as a result, the trees are coming back. And, you know, you've got 30 to 40 years' worth of growth of trees. Because in BR days, they would be just completely bare. They would keep it cut and would have sprayed it and all sorts of things. One of the reasons for that as well was because steam engines pushed out a lot of ash and stuff, and of course they didn't want line-side fires, which would get out of control. So.
Did they cut this through to make the railway track?
Well, they would have done, yeah, originally. A lot of it, as we go this way now, you can see the depth of cuttings. That's the top, effectively, top of the hill, and you've got, a cutting here about 40, 50 feet deep. And the reason why they made these cuttings so deep is because of this gradient problem, and they were fighting against the gradient all the time here, so that's why you've got these very deep, high-sided cuttings here.
Would they have used dynamite?
They probably would have used a little bit of dynamite, but a lot of it was done by hand. And, you know, this is predate sort of JCB diggers and things like that. It was all done by hand. It's a 15-mile stretch of railway line, and it took about 3 years to build, and it took them 3 years to get from Ilfracombe up to the top of the summit here, which is only a couple of miles, and yet they were able to build 14 miles of track the other side in about the same time. So it gives you an idea of how much work and engineering went on here. And the station at Ilfracombe is actually built on a plateau of soil that was taken out, and rock and that was taken out from here.
What's this, Dave?
It's a lime kiln, which was built probably between the late 1700s and the mid-1800s, used primarily to process limestone to use it for application on fields. Lime is also used for a whole host of other things, mortars and cements and renders, and obviously paint, particularly for whitewash for buildings. So very, very important element within the rural economy. Very little limestone in this part of the world, and most of it would have been imported from across the way in Wales, South Wales. There's a place called Caldy Island near Swansea, which is a limestone island, and so limestone would have been brought over together with coal and burnt in these kilns, and they would have raked the ash out of the bottom, basically, and then used that for whatever. What's interesting about this lime kiln, as you can probably imagine, is it's miles away from the sea. And so what's unusual about this lime kiln is it uses its own limestone. And there are outcrops of limestone between Coombe Martin and here, which would have been quarried and burnt in these kilns. So in this instance, all they would have brought in was coal. But that's a fair achievement to bring it up from sea level even then. There's a quarry around the back that this one would have served, as they call it.
Can you tell us about the walk we did today? Because that was centred around the railway.
That's right. The walk we did today basically was taking walkers from the centre of Ilfracombe, outside the Landmark Theatre, out along the old railway line that used to serve Ilfracombe back in the 1800s and 1900s, right out to Lee and then back along the coast path, which was a walk of about 8 miles in the end. And during that walk we looked at particularly the history of the railway. The railway was built in 1874 and was responsible for really transforming Ilfracombe into what was a very popular tourist destination in the late 1800s and during the 1900s.
Can you tell us more about the railway? Why was it so popular?
The railway was was built by the London and South Western Railway in 1874, and it was a very, very popular railway because Ilfracombe was becoming a very popular seaside resort. It was being sort of marketed as the Brighton of the North Devon coast to some extent, and lots of people were wanting to come down here, and the railway was one of the best ways of bringing people down. In the early 1800s, visitors to Ilfracombe tended to come in on paddle steamers from places like Bristol and Swansea, and it was quite a limited market. And what happened was, when the railway came, it really opened up the holiday resort to the masses to some extent.
How long did that go on for?
The railway ran until 1970. It was one of the last of the railways to be closed under the so-called beach enclosures. And so it was approximately 96 years that it ran for. And it was primarily a passenger route directly linked to Waterloo in London and an extension out from Barnstable.
How many passengers did it carry?
In its heyday, it was such a popular route just before the war, it was not unknown to see 26 passenger trains coming into Ilfracombe each day and bring in something like 10 to 15,000 people on a weekend into the resort.
Did any famous people come to Ilfracombe during its heyday?
There was, yes. I mean, we stood on the site of the Landmark Theatre, which originally was the old Ilfracombe Hotel, and there were some very, very important people came to stay in Ilfracombe in the sort of Victorian times. One notable guest was what was to be the future Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany, the Kaiser during the First World War, who came to stay here in 1878 under an assumed name, and stayed for a couple of weeks actually in the rooms at the Ilfracombe Hotel.
What about the rest of the town? How did that respond to the influx of visitors?
Well, it developed quite rapidly, and much of the building that you see here now is very sort of late Victorian, early Edwardian, as a direct result of people coming here on the railways.
And what about the future? Is there plans to bring back the paddle steamer?
The paddle steamers are mainly gone, but there are a few that still come into Ilfracombe now and again. We have the Waverley and the Balmoral steamships that come in, as well as our local ship, the Oldenburg. There has just recently been a new high-speed ferry link service that's been developed between here and Swansea, and to some extent it's recreating those old paddle steamer days, and hopefully this will do much to rejuvenate the sort of local economy within Ilfracombe.
Today when we were on the walk, you talked about some of the problems caused by people bringing in outside species such as Japanese knotweed and rhododendron. Can you tell us about the damage that does to the environment?
Well, basically they're introduced species. Japanese knotweed, as the name would suggest, has come from volcanic slopes of Mount Fuji in Japan. Rhododendron is also an introduced species, which basically have escaped from controlled conditions in gardens and lining drives and has got out into the natural countryside. Because these species are not native to this part of the world, they've got sort of out of hand. There is no natural controls or predators or anything to eat. They're growing unchecked and they're becoming a big problem within the countryside. They're out competing the native flora of the area.
What other jobs are you involved in your role as conservation?
Well, primarily my work is on the strategy side. It's a legal requirement that all AOMBs produce a management plan, and so a lot of my work is involved in producing a management plan which encourages other people to deliver the sorts of conservation that we would like to do within the area, be it the National Trust or the Forestry Commission or other organisations such as that. So I'm quite heavily involved in the development of the management plan. I have quite a responsibility with regards to planning. Obviously, in the name of conserving the natural beauty of the coastline, we're keen to ensure that the appropriate development takes place, and in some cases no development at all, and so I'm involved in commenting on planning applications that are submitted to the local authority as to whether or not they should or are appropriate to fit within the landscapes that they're proposed.
What about caravans? Have they reached saturation point in the area?
To some extent one would argue, certainly in the Mortoe area around Mort Point, that they have. It's a very difficult one, really, because caravans also bring a lot of tourists and that brings a lot of money. And so it's always a bit of a trade-off between conservation of the landscape and the economy at the end of the day. But primarily, we're concerned with the landscape. and conserving that landscape. And obviously caravan parks can impact upon that and introduce a development which may not be considered appropriate within that landscape.
Going back to the walking festival, is that a good way of making people appreciate the countryside and the sort of work that you're involved with?
I think it is, yeah. It's an excellent way in which we can, through leading walks, we can get across our conservation message, if you like, in an enjoyable way by providing information about the area, the historical side, as well as the sort of issues facing conservation and the landscape within the AOMB. We can raise people's awareness of the importance of AOMBs, but also provide enjoyment as well. And the walking festival for us is an ideal way of doing that.
It's twice a year now, isn't it?
That's right, yes. At the moment, it's twice a year. It always takes place over the May bank holiday weekend primarily, but over the last couple of seasons we've tried looking at doing walks in the autumn, mainly in the sort of September time. And it's really a way of trying to extend the tourist season to some extent to support the tourist economy as best we can by encouraging people to come and enjoy the local area outside of the main season.
And there's details of that on the internet.
There is. The Walking Festival is on the internet. If you Google search North Devon Walking Festival, it'll come up very easily. I'm afraid I can't remember the web address straight off, but it's very easy to find. And the whole range of walks, not just along the coast and in our AOMB, but all over North Devon and Exmoor, are available for people to take part in.
Well, a very pleasant beach, Ilfracombe, Coombe, if you've never been. Thank you very much to Dave Edgecombe and Antia for that. Well, spring has sprung, and with it, the Waverley Steam Navigation Company, a charity, will be running its roughly weekly old-fashioned boat trips around the Bristol Channel. Dialect's Tony Gosling went on board the SS Waverley to sample the delights of 1930s-style shipping.
Well, hello, Tony. Welcome aboard Balmoral. It's really good to see you today. My name's Alec Lewis. I'm the agent for Waverley Excursions for this side of the channel, in the Bristol Channel. And this afternoon, we're going to make our way down channel here from Portishead on a lovely sunny afternoon now to down to past Clevedon and out round the Holme Islands. Now, the Holme Islands were at one time the western extremity of the city of Bristol. The boundary of the city of Bristol actually included the islands. And so we're really still going to be within the city and county of Bristol as we go down channel this afternoon on this lovely afternoon trip.
Can you tell us something about the ship that we're on? Is it a ship, first of all, or a boat?
Oh, it's definitely a ship, yes, definitely. A boat is something that usually has oars. Now, this, fortunately, I don't think this one's going to need oars today. Yes, the Balmoral, she's the last of the White Funnel steamers, the famous company that used to operate the excursions trips around the Bristol Channel, which unfortunately folded in 1980. But the charity that this ship is a part of today keeps this ship and the Waverley going to maintain this lovely tradition of coastal cruising around the UK, particularly here in the Bristol Channel too.
Steepholme was very heavily fortified during the last war, and you could see evidence of gun emplacements around it, particularly as we get a little bit closer and on to the other side. It's possible to land on Steepholme on quite a regular basis from Weston-super-Mare. The small vessel Bristol Queen sails out there for most weeks in the summer for day trips. And details of those you'll get from the Tourist Information Office in Weston-super-Mare. It takes about 45 minutes to come out from Weston, weather permitting.
Sydney Robinson from Penarth, has been sailing on these ships for over 80 years and still thoroughly enjoying it. I think you ought to have a chat with him, Tony. So over to you, Sydney.
Right. Well, Alex says, I on the 22nd of August this year, I went to Ilfracombe on the Balmoral, and that was. But it was a celebration day because it was the 80 years to the day when I made my first trip to Ilfracombe on the Westward Ho, the paddler steamer Westward Ho, from Newport, calling it Weston, and then on to Ilfracombe. The fare I paid was 7 shillings and 6 pence.
So what is the attraction now?
I've been working in shipping all my life, in any case, for a living. So I've always had a fascination for anything connected with the marine activities. Well, I've always had a great interest, not only in this particular ship, but in the many other ships which operated in the same way as this ship. I can remember the before the war, we had eight of P&A Campbell ships, paddle steamers, operating in the Bristol Channel each season. And we also had three of them operating on the south coast, mainly from the Sussex resorts. And I had the, I suppose that I'd say almost the distinction today of having travelled on all 11 of Campbell's ships. Very few people can have done that.
What is it that you think is marks these kind of ships apart?
Well, these ships are extremely unique. The range of sailing activities was much wider in the 1930s than it is even in the present day. Oh, I was spent over 60 years in the ship repairing business, the operate dry docks. I started work in 1932 with the ship repairing industry, and prior to that, I worked for the Newport Shipowners Association at Newport. And apart from being the organisation to represent the interests of Newport shipowners, they also operated the coal trimmers scheme. In the 1930s, there were over 400 coal trimmers employed at Newport, and they were self-employed, and the Newport Shipowners Association sort of managed their financial affairs. I mean, they had the daily returns of the amount of coal that was shipped on the various vessels at Newport docks. There were different rates for of pay for the type of ship which they loaded with coal. I mean, some were called easy trimmers. There were rates for loading coal into the main holds, into the between decks, into the cross bunkers and the thwartship bunkers. And then I started, as I say, in 1932 with the ship repairing industry, and I worked in that industry until I was 79.
So how's the shipping world changed?
Oh, enormous changes. As a matter of fact, the ship repairing industry has almost vanished in this country. When I was at Cardiff, there were 13 ship repairing yards and dry docks. There were 8 at Newport, 5 in Swansea, and as well as several in Avonmouth. But I first started with the Mount Stuart dry docks in Cardiff. And after some years, I was transferred to the Mount Stuart dry docks works and dry dock at Avonmouth. And I spent many, many years at Avonmouth. And the dry dock at Avonmouth was the fourth largest dry dock in the country. So we were able to take some exceptionally large ships, particularly during the war years. The biggest ship I can remember going into Avonmouth Dock was the Monica Bermuda, owned by Furness Withy. She was a gross tonnage of about 30,000.
So we've now completed our circuit of the two islands, and we head back towards Avonmouth. And over on the starboard side, just passing the headland of Breen Down. To the right of that is the beach at Barrow, leading on to Breen. And on the left-hand side of Breen Down is, of course, Weston-super-Mare.
Well, thank you very much to Tony Gosling. Sounds like he enjoyed himself there. And that was Sydney Robinson and Alec Lewis on board the SS Waverley, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. The tickets for that are at about £25. And here's a bit more information. SS Balmoral and Waverley sail from Clevedon in Bristol, and Weston, Ilfracombe, Minehead, Sharpness, Portishead, Bridgewater, Watchet and Exeter, so there's plenty of places to get on board. And there's self-service restaurant, lounges, a souvenir shop. If that kind of thing sounds interesting to you, then check out waverleyexcursions.co.uk, or they've got a phone number, pencils at the ready, 0845 130 4647, or visit waverleyexcursions.co.uk. Short piece of music now. This is another track from West Country Night Out by Tom and Barbara Brown, and this one's called The Watchet Sailor.
I was a-walking down Watchet Swain Street, a jolly old shipmate I chanced for to meet. Hello, brother sailor, you're welcome to home. In season to watch it, I think you are come. Now don't you remember once courting a maid? Now through your long absence, she's going to be wed. Tomorrow in Bristol, this wedding's to be. And I am invited, the same for to see. Jack went and got license that very same night, and walked into Bristol as soon as 'twas light. He sat in the temple churchyard for a while, till he saw the bride coming, which caused him to smile. He went and he took this fair maid by the hand. You're going to be married, as I understand. Well, if you are to marry, then you'll be my bride. And I have come here for to change your design. Oh, now, said this fair maid, it's what shall I do? For I know I was solemnly promised to you. Well, it's you are my sweetheart, and I'll be your bride. For there's none in this world I could fancy beside.
That was from the album West Country Night Out, and that one was called The Watch It Say That. Now over to Malcolm Grieve as ever to read this week's instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell.
To Light by David Southwell. For a field based on evidence, fact, and the search for truth, it comes as a surprise that science and scientists have been so involved in keeping secrets and telling lies. Many of science's secrets stem from the fact that no one likes to be proved wrong. No one who is meant to be an authority on a subject likes to be caught out as not knowing as much as they pretend to. The extreme embarrassment factor only increases if something fundamental to your knowledge system is exposed as being wrong. However, some truths are more than discomforting. They can do real damage. Not only do school textbooks get rewritten, careers are ended, and the authoritarian grip certain established academic elites have held on subjects from beyond living memory is loosened. It also seems that the scientific establishment tries hard to ensure that information about successful scientists who contradict the public perception of their ranks as a collection of sober rationalists is repressed. It is as if they think that a public who knew that great scientific minds took drugs and believed in the occult would no longer have a belief in the amazing discoveries of those scientists. The biggest lie that many scientists peddle is that their theories are not only absolute, but they arise from totally dispassionate analysis of the facts. The truth is that for many of them, their belief in certain theories is almost religious and can only be maintained by ignoring the facts that prove them incomplete. There is much hype about scientific discoveries. Hyperbole such as revolutionary and paradigm shifting are used in the same way advertising people use major new advance in whiteness to sell soap powder. In 1953, Francis Crick went into his local pub in Cambridge on a February evening and told the whole pub that we have found the secret of life. For once, someone was not exaggerating. Crick and his colleague Dr. James Watson had worked out the double helix structure of deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, and that it could unzip to make copies of itself. This discovery revolutionized biology, medicine, and how we see the world. It led to the creation of the biotechnology industry and provides hope that through genetics we may conquer some of the worst diseases to afflict the human race. Much has been written about the discovery, but the role LSD played is almost always ignored. Crick told biochemist Richard Kemp that he often used small doses of LSD to boost his powers of thought, and that he had first perceived the double helix shape while on LSD, using the vision as a basis for his research. This staggering revelation, as well as Crick's idea that life on Earth began when a spaceship from a higher civilization dropped microorganisms, is rarely mentioned in any scientific literature. Francis Crick was not alone in the world of science when it comes to the creative use of LSD. Dr. Carey Mullis, the 1993 Nobel Prize winner for chemistry, an inventor of PCR, without which genetic engineering would not be possible, claimed in an interview that, "I doubt if I would have invented PCR if I hadn't taken LSD. It allowed me to sit on a DNA molecule and watch the polymers go by." While there is a blue plaque in the Eagle Pub in Cambridge city centre to mark where Crick made his dramatic statement, there is no corresponding commemoration of the place where he took the LSD that led to his revelation about the double helix. Ask anyone how the universe started, and the answer usually comes back with a big bang. Ask a scientist, and you may get the answer that a tiny bubble of space-time, a trillionth of a centimetre across, spontaneously popped into existence out of nothing due to random quantum fluctuation that led to the Big Bang. Since it replaced the steady-state theory, the previous hypothesis on the origins of the universe in 1965, the Big Bang theory has become the cornerstone of scientific orthodoxy. It is the ultimate paradigm, even used as a phrase by those who have no idea of the details of the alleged single most significant event in creation. Given all of this, surely there is no reason to believe that there is good evidence for believing that the theory may be wrong. Surely all of those famous scientists we have seen expanding on the Big Bang on television for the last 40 years cannot be wrong. The case against the theory does not rest on just one single piece of evidence, but on a whole phalanx of observations that contradict it. These range from the universe having a much too large a scale structure to have formed in the time allotted, to the fact that the age of some globular clusters seem to be older than the universe itself should be. In 2004, 33 leading scientists sent an open letter to the scientific community via New Scientist magazine. The letter started, "Big Bang relies on a number of hypothetical entities, things we have never observed. Without them, there would be a fatal contradiction between the observations made by astronomers and the predictions of the theory. In no other field of physics would this be accepted as a way of bridging the gap between theory and observation." The letter called for funding to investigate alternative theorems and an end to the dogmatic holding to the Big Bang theory by scientists, claiming, "Never has such a mighty edifice been built on such insubstantial foundations." Despite this, orthodox scientists continue to promote the Big Bang theory and obstruct research into other views. The image of scientists fixed in the public consciousness is of men of logic who have no truck with magic and the supernatural. Jack Whiteside Parsons was a brilliant chemist whose work on the composition of liquid rocket fuel revolutionised space science. At 25, alongside two colleagues, he set up America's first government-backed rocket research group, helped establish the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, at Pasadena, and co-founded the Aerojet General Corporation, which now manufactures the solid fuel boosters used by the space shuttle. According to journalist Richard Metzger, even Wernher von Braun, the Nazi rocket scientist who led the US race into space, described Parsons as the true father of the American space program. While most men would settle for trying to break the bonds of gravity, Parsons would settle for nothing less than being able to transcend all time and space. Not only a scientist, he was also an occultist. It is for this reason he has been purposefully excluded from many scientific history books, including those written about the jet propulsion laboratory he helped to create. As a member of the California Agape Lodge of the Ordo Templi Orientis, Parsons was a magical adept and favoured pupil of the infamous British occultist Aleister Crowley, who had created the OTO. A fellow member of the lodge was the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, who worked with Parsons on a magical ritual known as the Babylon Working, before running off with Parsons' mistress and $50,000 of his money. Parsons was also an accomplished philosophical writer, penning Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword, one of the classics of libertarian thought. Parsons was investigated by the FBI and hounded out of the country. Then, after his mysterious death at the age of 38, his fellow scientists began to erase Parsons' part in the history of rocketry. However, despite the scientific establishment's campaign to hide all knowledge of the notorious sex magician in their ranks, Jack Parsons' name lives on. Some scientists working at JPL now affectionately call it the Jack Parsons Lab, while French astronomers have named a crater on the moon after him.
David Southwell there, thank you very much to him for his book Secrets and Lies and letting us read it, and thank you to Malcolm Greaves for his efforts. Trevor Carter, our resident bard, is here to give you his latest poem, The Bard of Windmill Hill on Dialect Radio. Hello.
Hello, John.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm much better than last week, thank you.
You had a bit of a cold. You're a bit ill.
Yeah, the bronchitis is on its way out, I'm glad to say.
Brilliant. What have you got?
This is to do with a book review. I reviewed a book called When China Rules the World by Martin Jacks for the Festival of Ideas, which is coming up soon if anybody's interested in intellectual matters. And
yeah. Okay, well, there will be certainly a lot of things
highbrow lectures and book launches and, you know, lots of cutting edge stuff, really.
Yeah.
It's all happening. So this is, if you can't be bothered to read the book is, it's fantastic read, but it is over 400 pages and quite demanding. So, you know, if you can't be bothered to read a book, I thought, well, I'll just try to sum it up. Basically, what he's talking about is the fact that China will be ruling the world very soon. In fact, they virtually already are, to be honest. Because people are always saying there's all this debt crisis and financial chaos, and say, well, who actually holds the cards? Who is actually in credit? Well, of course, China's in credit, really.
Mm.
And Indeed. That's the sort of thing he's talking about.
Right.
So there, yeah. It's called Return of the Dragon. The sleeping dragon has awoken from its long century of sleep. Now that history's spell is broken, there are old promises to keep. A century of subjugation, and yet the dragon did not die, but slumbered in deep resignation till occupiers said goodbye. Till nationalism's resurrection restored the dragon's dormant pride and set about the great correction. State sponsoring a rapid ride from paddy fields to plastic factories, from bicycles to four-wheel drives, down muddy tracks to superhighways, transforming ordinary lives. The dragon views its destined path to raise the standard of the East, and knows that in the aftermath the Western Star will be released. Empires will come, empires will go, a great transcendence has begun. The new world order soon will know the ancient empire of the sun. The dragon eyes its glorious future, the Western world looks on aghast. Surrounding tigers pay their homage, the dragon takes the throne at last. Past meets future in the present, world history turns upon its head. The dragon knows the future's colour. The future will be coloured red.
Ominous indeed.
Ominous indeed, indeed.
Thank you very much to Trevor Carter.
Thank you, John.
Well, time once again for our very own Jeff Sparks, resplendent in Motorhead regalia. All the Aces is the one that he features today. What's going on in Bristol?
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. starting with Wednesday 12th of May, and Attila the Stockbroker will be performing with support from David Rovics and also Gecko at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £6 in advance and £8 on the door. On Thursday 13th of May, Louisiana Red will be performing with Michael Messer at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £10 in advance, £12 on the door. Into Friday 14th of May, White Rabbits will be performing with support from Active Child at the Cooler in Park Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £8 in advance. On to Song of the Week and our future Otis Spann. He was born in 1930 and started performing in the 1940s and recording from the mid-1950s. He passed away in 1970, aged 40 years old. He is considered by many to be Chicago's leading post-war blues pianist. This is the track I'd Rather Be the Devil, which also features B.B. King on guitar, and is from the album Up Jump the Devil, American Devil Songs, 1920s to 1950s. Otis Spann with I'd Rather Be the Devil from the album Up Jump the Devil, American Devil Songs, 1920s to 1950s. Moving on to Saturday 15th of May, The Fall will be performing at Cheese and Grain in Market Yard, Froome. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £17.50 in advance and £21 on the door. Also on 15th of May, Alabama 3 will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £16 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 16th of May, Andy Haig Fortet will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9pm and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And that's the end of this week's Dalek Show. Just a reminder, if you want to check out the book about the Tattoo Project, in fact, there is a website, thetattooproject.co.uk. You can go along to the book launch on May the 28th at the Halo Cafe Bar on Gloucester Road. And if you have a tattoo story that you'd like to tell, email toptatstories@hotmail.com. Well, studio guests this week were Jude English and Hazel Hammond. Thank you very much to those. And Malcolm Greaves for reading a chapter, Secrets and Lies, by David Southwell. The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. And the poem was by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and Dialect Radio.
What's On by Jeff Sparks, and the studio engineer was Johnny Royden. The producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye to Martin Jasmine and Helene Ilfracombe, the latest listeners to join the show. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's Starlex Radio. Goodbye.